I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The flight recorders from two Russian airplanes which crashed separately but almost simultaneously last night outside Moscow have been found and taken to the Russian capital for investigation. Russia's top security agency says there is no evidence on the ground of terrorist activity, and Chechenian separatist rebel leaders denied any connection to the crashes. At least 89 passengers are reported dead. Well, joining us on the line from just outside Moscow is Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor. Fred, are officials at all thinking that these two crashes could have been a coincidence?
They are loudly suggesting that. They're suggesting it might have been bad fuel, which is a common problem in Russian airports, but it usually causes accidents in the wintertime, you know, when and not in the summertime. I don't really think that that holds water. I think if officials don't want to panic the public about terrorism again, because we've had a long line of bombings and various terrorist acts in Russia for which no one claims responsibility. More recently, for instance, we've had a bombing in the Moscow metro in February that killed 40 people. And typically, in cases like this, there is no claim of responsibility. So this fits a pattern. And the coincidences are just too mind-boggling. You know, two planes crashing from high altitude within 4 minutes of each other. And earlier on Tuesday evening, there was another bombing on the Kashirskaya Chaussee, which is the main road leading to Domodedovo Airport, which is where the two planes left from. So I just don't think that an accident or a freak coincidence can possibly explain this.
Would Chechen separatists deny a connection to something? Would they make that statement, or would they make no statement? I mean, what's been the history?
They routinely deny it, and it might indeed not be the rebel president and his men, Aslan Maskarov. It might be Islamic fundamentalist groups or some other group which is not under the command of the rebel leaders. We just don't know, but there certainly is a pattern here into which last night's accidents would neatly fit.
And Fred, one last question. Wasn't there a hijack signal on at least one of the planes?
Yes, officials are also downplaying that, but the airline insists that there was a distress signal from its plane just moments before it disappeared. The evidence just adds up to sabotage or terrorism of some kind.
Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor, he's speaking to us from just outside Moscow in the town of Razdory. Fred, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
While at a campaign rally in Davenport, Iowa yesterday, Vice President Dick Cheney made his most direct public comments to date about his openly gay daughter. And he had this to say about gay relationships.
My general view is that freedom means freedom for everyone. People ought to be free to enter into any kind of relationship they want to.
Cheney also disagreed with President Bush's position on a federal constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, saying that he, Cheney, personally believes that decision should be left to the states, but that the president makes policy. Joining us on the line is Patrick Guerrero. He's executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a group that supports equality for gays and lesbians within the GOP. Hello.
Good to be with you.
And your response to Dick Cheney's comments?
Well, it was obviously a deeply personal statement. He loves his daughter, both his daughters. I think that public acknowledgement for the first time in a loving way that his daughter is gay sends a powerful message across the country. The concern is it's on the heels of a party platform draft that was released over the last 24 hours that really marginalizes gay and lesbian Americans and doesn't reach out to moderate voters.
I just want to ask you something, Patrick, about your thoughts that this was the first time Dick Cheney had made these remarks. He did state his position on gay marriage in 2000 when he also said freedom means freedom for everybody when he was, you know, running as vice president.
I think what he didn't say in the 2000 debate was he didn't acknowledge publicly that he had a gay daughter. I think just doing that, he's the highest level public official in the history of the country who has acknowledged that he has a gay family member that sits at that table on Thanksgiving dinner, just like so many families across the country. And he had repeated again his powerful position against the federal government regulating marriage, that's an issue that should be left up to states. We agree with Dick Cheney. It's why we featured him in a in our organization's first television ad in 27 years of existence that highlighted you can be conservative in America, believe in families and strong family values, but also we shouldn't write discrimination into the Constitution.
But is any of it going to make a difference in what happens next week?
Maybe not. And one of the things our organization is doing during the New York Convention is making sure that if this party attempts to put lipstick on a pig, we remind people of what's underneath the lipstick. It's not acceptable to us to put our best friends in prime time, folks like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rudy Giuliani, George Pataki, John McCain, all who oppose a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage and jeopardizing civil unions, and all who have reached out to moderates when it comes to social issues. It's not fair to put those people up in prime time and then every other time play to the base and play to the very far right.
What are you and members of the Log Cabin Republicans going to do? Are you going to take this to a floor fight, this plank?
Yeah, we're working with other groups who feel excluded in the platform, pro-choice groups, groups of younger Republicans who feel like the party at least should at the end of the platform say that folks who disagree on issues like gay and lesbian concerns and abortion and family planning, stem cell research and other issues are welcome within the party. If the party can't even make that very basic statement that they want our support, they want us in the big tent, that doesn't bode well for November.
Will you or your members leave the party over the plank on gay marriage?
No, we're committed to stay in this party and fight. The far right, the radical groups, want us to leave the party so that there won't be a debate around social issues. It's important for all Americans who believe in inclusion and who believe in fairness for gay and lesbian Americans and keeping government out of the bedroom that groups like ours, even though the days might be tough, stay and fight and do it with principle, do it with integrity, and actually take on our party when we believe it's necessary on such important issues.
Well, Patrick, before we let you go, your thoughts on one other sentence in the proposed plank in the Republican platform. When it comes to gay marriage, it goes on to say, a constitutional amendment passed by Congress and ratified by the states is vulnerable to being overturned by activist judges. Your thoughts on the what's become the pejorative use of that phrase, activist judges?
Federalism is working real well. There's a balance of power both in the state and federal levels of our government. Six out of the seven justices who called for gay marriage equality in Massachusetts were Republican appointees. Democrats shot down a decision by the mayor of San Francisco and California. And you can't pick and choose when you like federalism or not. You can't pick and choose when you like the court's involvement in American democracy. I have a great faith in the American system. It's worked well over the years. And in the end, we're going to figure out a way to have fairness and equality for all Americans, including gay and lesbian Americans, through the legislatures, through the courts, and through the goodwill and fair-minded nature of the American people.
Patrick, thank you.
You're welcome.
Patrick Guerrero is Executive Director of the Log Cabin Republicans. Of all the dramas that have played out at the Olympic Games in Athens, few rival the story of the Iraqi soccer team. Every kick the team takes is dogged by the ongoing war back home, by the cruel history of Uday Hussein's murderous rule over Iraqi sports, and by the U.S. presidential election. Thanasis Kambanis covers Iraq for the Boston Globe. He's now in his native Greece covering the progress of the Iraqi teams, and he joins us from Athens. Welcome, Thanasi.
Hi, Robin. It's good to be here.
How is the Iraqi soccer team playing, first of all?
Well, they were playing effective, if not beautiful, soccer until last night when they, I would have to say, they collapsed on the field against the Paraguayans. The inexperience and the youth of the team showed, and it was sort of heartbreaking to watch because these fans had come from all over Greece and they were cheering their hearts out for the soccer players, and you could tell that the soccer players were playing as hard as they could, and they were just overmatched and outgunned.
What's at stake here? You write that these were Iraq's most successful international athletes. Before the regime fell, they were subject to beatings or prisons when they lost, and prizes like sports cars if they won.
I mean, I think the part of why they've seized everyone's imagination so much is because they are so emblematic, both for better and for worse, of the changes that have happened in Iraqi society. Their presence here at the Olympics, I mean, I think for the people back in Iraq, has been quite simply just a wonderful diversion from an everyday reality that is increasingly unpleasant, as we see from the fighting right now in Najaf. So it's just something to be purely and simply excited about something Iraqi that everyone could root for without worrying what religion they were, what political persuasion they were. And frankly, something, as a lot of the people I talked to described, it's a chance to show Iraqis as successful, capable people who aren't violent.
Well,
and that means a lot.
Well, in fact, the team is a tremendous mix of Iraqis.
Yeah, I mean, there are folks from Sadr City, there are Kurds from the north, there are Sunnis, there are Shiites. There's different languages, different dialects spoken, and they seem to get along very well. And several of them, about half of them, I think, have played together for as long as 5 years on national youth teams there.
Well, and now the team has reacted to being included in President George Bush's campaign ads. In a spot, there's flags from Iraq and Afghanistan, and a narrator says, "At this Olympics, there will be two more free nations and two fewer terrorist regimes." What have the players said about that?
Well, the players, as well as the coach, have been pretty outspoken in their anger at what they see as the politicization of their sporting odyssey at the Olympics. The coach, I think at every opportunity that he's spoken to the press, has underscored that he likes American people, but that America as a nation has destroyed his country, which is what he said to us last night after the game. And I think, you know, it's not at all atypical for what almost any Iraqi will tell you on the street in Iraq. It's interesting to see them saying this in the very sort of overcharged, media-saturated environment of the Olympics.
How much are the Iraqis bringing up, and how much are they being forced to bring it up?
The Iraqis are being continuously put in the position of having to talk about politics when they want to talk about sports. I mean, like, you know, we saw this again last night after the game. The coach wanted to talk about the offsides that he believes the Paraguayans committed, and all the reporters wanted to ask him what he thought about the political situation at home, what he thought of the Bush ad, what he thought of the fighting at Najaf. And same with the players. I mean, I was with the players before the game yesterday, and I too was guilty of asking them these questions about politics. And you know, they're 19, 20, 22-year-old kids getting ready to play soccer, and that's what their heads generally seem full of.
Well, we understand that the Iraqi team is out of the gold medal run, but despite all the politics, another soccer game is going to break out Friday night.
Yes, and they're going to be playing for the bronze against Italy. And when one of them said to me, it would be one of the best gifts, he said, that this team could give the Iraqi people if they could bring them back a medal and give them something pure and uncomplicated to feel happy about and proud of.
Well, Thanasis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanasis Kambanis reporting for the Boston Globe in Athens. Just ahead, the trust factor in American politics. And later, we speak to former Secretary of the Navy and 9/11 Commission member John Layman about the recent proposal to reorganize U.S. intelligence gathering. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Presidential candidate John Kerry pledged to restore trust in the White House at last month's Democratic National Convention. And next week, President Bush will have the chance to say why Americans should trust him. Trust is a hot-button word on the campaign trail. And recently, Here and Now's Gail Harris spoke about the issue of trust with Les Chorba, former special assistant to the first President Bush and now author of the new book, Trust, The One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader.
Let me start by your basic premise. Why do you think that trust is the single most important aspect of leadership?
Well, I think that if a leader wants to lead followers in an organization to a destination that they don't necessarily wish to arrive at, whether that's in political life or in business, they've got to develop credibility and reliability, and they do that by building trust with their followers. And once that trust is built, I think a leader has to be very careful to maintain that trust. But also, I also in the book, make the case that followers, many of whom serve in quiet leadership roles, are really the ones that make our country and our institutions great. It's not just the high-profile leaders, the ones that are out front, but those quiet, unassuming leaders who day in and day out lead in so many effective ways.
Well, in the public arena, is it difficult to establish that trust by being sort of low-key and quiet? Because isn't there always the temptation to puff up your record or make it look as good as possible?
Well, of course, I think you've hit on an important distinction. In the political realm, there is a tendency to perhaps exaggerate and embellish and pursue things for expedience sake and not doing what is necessarily the right thing. And so we probably see a higher cynicism towards politicians than we do in any other institution, although I should say over the last 3 to 4 years, we have seen a high level of distrust in our corporate executives.
Well, trust certainly seems to be an issue in the presidential campaign. There are questions raised about John Kerry's record in Vietnam, whether perhaps it had been a bit embellished. George Bush is being accused of misleading the American public into a costly war based on false assumptions about weapons of mass destruction. To Bush first, has he explained that decision adequately in a way that people feel that he can be trusted on decisions about security, about when to go to war?
Well, it's a good point. I think trust is becoming the issue in this campaign. John Kerry, in his acceptance speech, sort of laid down the gauntlet when he said he wanted to restore trust and credibility to the White House, which was a direct attack on this president's character. But President Bush, after 9/11, did build a high level of trust. Most of the polls showed that after 9/11, he had about a 77% trust rating with the American people. And since then, as we all know, I think his opponents have tried to poke holes in that trust by suggesting that he misled us into war. But I think there is a distinction that we need to make, and that is leaders who are worthy of trust develop a track record of credibility and reliability over a long period of time. And also, they don't make decisions or bad decisions willfully or consciously. I don't think any intellectually honest observer can argue that the President of the United States willfully and maliciously misled the United States into war. And so it shows certainly a serious intelligence blunder, but certainly not willful deception. And I think that's an important distinction to make.
Well, how does a leader go about reestablishing trust when that trust has been broken or at least bent? I mean, is it even possible?
Well, it's difficult. In the president's case, I think that he needs to show the kind of leadership that he demonstrated after 9/11, which was a combination of both strength and resolve, but also the humanity and the grief and the compassion that he showed soon after 9/11. I think that would be one way of rebuilding the trust that perhaps may have been tarnished.
How is it, do you think, that so many leaders, and I'm thinking here of some of the corporate scandals that we've seen, they just delude themselves into thinking that they can get away with things, and so they proceed on?
Well, I think that's part of it. They become full of themselves and extremely arrogant. I'm reminded of the wonderful quote from Professor Howard Hendricks, who once said that there's no smaller package than a man who is wrapped up in himself. And I think we saw a lot of corporate leaders who were wrapped up in themselves and felt that they could bend the rules to pursue greed and ambition. And I think the other thing that happened in corporate America is that a lot of leaders forgot that business is fundamentally a moral activity. While results and profits and cash flow and all those numerical measurements are important in a business, it's just as important, in fact, even more important, how we achieve those results. And that's really the thrust of the book.
It also seems that you're saying, just in our conversation here, not necessarily in the book, although perhaps you explore it there too, how do you make the distinction between that personal trustworthiness, being willing to essentially say, hey, my life is an open book.
Right.
Take a look. This is who I am. When many people would say, well, I may have lived a pretty good life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I've never done anything wrong. And it's that very scrutiny that often leads people away from leadership, again, particularly in the political arena.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, because we all have had areas of weakness and mistakes, even as leaders. And I discuss that in the book. Moral leaders aren't perfect leaders. My point is that a moral leader or a leader of character is someone who is intent in the present to do the right thing for the right reasons. And it's not as important who you once were, but who you are now in your particular leadership role. And I think if a leader is honest and transparent about learning from the mistakes early on in life and how they can apply that to their current role of leadership, I think that builds trust. I think that people generally are very fair and are willing to give leaders a second chance.
Les, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Les Chorba speaking to Here Now's Gail Harris. His new book is called Trust, The One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we check in on the military tribunals underway at Guantanamo Bay, and protesters gear up for the RNC in New York. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So far, not many movers and shakers in Washington are lining up behind the latest plan to reform U.S. intelligence. This week, Kansas Senator Pat Roberts proposed completely rearranging the nation's spy agencies under a single national intelligence director. Some say that would abolish the CIA. The top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, Senator Jay Rockefeller, calls that a severe mistake. But the chair of the September 11th commission said yesterday that this far-reaching proposal might be a constructive alternative to the commission's own proposals for intelligence reform put forth last month. Well, joining us on the line is another member of the 9/11 commission, John Layman. He served as Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan, and he joins us now. Commissioner Layman, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And I want to ask you first for your reaction to Commission Chair Thomas Kane's comments that Mr. Roberts' plan proposed a constructive alternative. He didn't go as far to endorse it, but he did say it might be a good idea. Your thoughts?
Well, I think this is a very good development indeed, because it shows that a consensus is emerging in Congress that our analysis of the problems after our 20-month study is something that they accept and agree with, and that radical changes are needed, not just tinkering, not moving deck chairs around, but fundamental reforms both in Congress and in the executive branch.
Well, someone asked, why not just abolish the CIA outright? Mr. Roberts' plan would split it into three separate agencies. Why not just wipe the slate clean?
Well, I think that there are arguments for doing that and starting completely anew. But I think that in government, starting over again with an entirely new recruiting program is not the way to go. There are a lot of different ways to achieve the common sense effectiveness that we need to have in our intelligence community. We did not arrive at our recommendations lightly, but it's very helpful to have other alternatives and have the debate proceed at the pace it's doing, deliberately but without delay, because we are in a war. And by the way, that is no argument for not making fundamental reforms, to say, oh, wait till the war is over. This is going to be a 20-year war at least.
A 20-year war?
I think it's going to be at least a decades-long war. This is a war against Islamist terrorism, which has deep roots and is not going to be extirpated in a brief period of time.
Well, Commissioner, as you know, there has been concern expressed about making changes now from Senators John Warner and Carl Levin of the Senate Armed Services Committee, from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who said you can't go tearing up the pea patch in wartime, and from people who fear most that the military intelligence is going to be interrupted?
Well, support of the military is the first and most important function of our intelligence community, and all of us on the commission completely agree. Anything that would interfere with the effective service of the troops in the field is something to be avoided. But the fact is, the fault lies in this stovepiping, this ossified bureaucracy that has evolved, the separation, inability to share. And so to say that we can't do anything that might disrupt things is just wrong. And I think that that they will see that.
Well, what is to prevent that ossifying, that failure to communicate between agencies? What's to prevent that from happening again? I mean, it seems to be the nature of the business, secrecy.
Well, people have to get it out of their mind that if we just change these boxes around, we can fix it. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is the way that all the great revolution in American productivity over the last 20 years has taken place. You have to adopt a culture of constant improvement, constant change. We've got to get this cultural change.
If we could talk for a second just about the specifics of the plan, and by the way, everybody seems to agree that it's just a jumping-off point, and it's probably going to be adjusted, but it's a place to start. There's going to be a some sort of national intelligence director, as your commission recommended. He will have four deputies in the Roberts plan, and will split up various parts of intelligence. How else is it going to work? Can you give us another specific that you think will make the system different?
Well, I think that the Roberts plan is one variant. Ours is a very different approach, and I think the principles that have to be kept in the forefront is that there has to be a national intelligence director with real power, power over money and power over hiring and firing.
Let me stop you there. The Bush administration does agree to create such a position, but not at the cabinet level and lacking budgetary control.
Yes, and I'm fairly confident that the Bush administration will end up in that position. They have not opposed yet. It is very much under discussion within the administration. Getting there, they will see that the logic requires that official have both power over money and power over hiring and firing.
Commissioner Layman, more than three dozen intelligence reform plans have been floated on Capitol Hill in the past five decades. All of them have failed. What do you think is going to happen this time around?
I think it's going to succeed. I think that what you're seeing, imagine the U.S. Congress in an election year giving up its six-week vacation. I mean, that's startling. But it shows that they are working hard. They have been here. The committees have been working. I'm here in Washington testifying all day today for the fourth time, and they're taking it seriously. And there's going to be an enactment of, I believe, the fundamentals of the reforms that we recommended in the commission. The details are part of the debate, and I think we're going to come to a very radical and very effective solution.
Before you go, can we just ask you one question about your time on the commission?
Sure.
As a Republican, did you feel at times defensive about the current administration or protective of?
Well, hardly, because I think we were all transformed by the experience. We were all appointed by partisan Republicans and partisan Democrats, and we're all Republicans or Democrats. And the fact that through that 20-month period, we all became totally unified with a unity of purpose that just pushed aside any political differences was an amazing process. What was seen on the public hearings, unfortunately, gave the public a distorted picture of what really goes on in the commission. Two of the hearings, particularly, although it was understandable because of the lines of questioning, but we truly became a totally nonpartisan commission, which is why we reached the total unanimity, not only in the findings, but in the lessons learned, and now more importantly, in the recommendations. These are not lowest common denominator recommendations. These are very punchy, as is the whole report.
John Layman, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
John Layman, member of the National Commission on Terrorism Attacks Upon the United States. He also served as Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan. Still to come, a Colby College professor discusses life as a man and then as a woman. You're listening to Here and Now. It's back to school time for many, but for students at the New England Culinary Institute, or NECI, learning happens all year round, and a lot of it is on the job. NECI, which is based in Vermont, sends aspiring chefs to catering events as part of their training. But what happens when that caterer in training is working at someone else's once-in-a-lifetime wedding? Here now, producer Emiko Tamagawa went behind the scenes to find out.
Go into the chapel and rip. Gonna get married.
Hi, I'm Tempe Evans, and I'm the bride.
I'm Jeremy Wright, and I'm the groom.
What made you choose NECI?
Primarily because we were familiar with their work. We've eaten at the restaurant downtown in Burlington several times, and they had also catered another wedding here.
Are you at all nervous about the fact that a bunch of students are going to be catering your wedding?
Well, yeah, but isn't everybody at some point, you know? I mean, I'm very confident in what NECI has to offer in an educational way.
Hi, I'm Chris from Wisconsin, and I'm a student at NECI.
My name is Tom Sweet, and I'm from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and I'm a second-year student also.
What are you expecting this Saturday?
Some excitement, some instant gratification. A lot of times at events, people come up and tell you how good your food is and how good things are, and that's always satisfying.
I'm Chef Sue Dabowski. I'm an instructor here at NECI, and we're building up to a busy Saturday. Myself and the two students with me, we will be working on an event, a wedding, outdoor wedding.
So what is it like to balance the needs of, you know, teaching students, but also having to do the professional quality of a wedding?
We have to have more planning time, allow more time for orchestrating the event, have a little bit more patience. We haven't been working together long as you would with a built-up staff.
What happens when things go wrong?
Well, there's all kinds of stories, like the truck getting stuck in the mud when you're going to an event that's in a field. The cake falling apart, you know, it got too hot in the transportation, or even getting locked up in gridlock on the highway. A lot of times, you know, you have to have all these logistics worked out and communicate, because it's not just us. We have the whole front of the house staff involved and the bar staff, and so everybody has to be on their mark.
Join me with a great big round of applause together in public for the first time as husband and wife, Tempe and Jeremy.
Give me the asparagus right now. Put sauce on it.
We ran into a couple little hitches. It's a learning opportunity for the students. And ultimately, the client did not suffer in any fashion. So just by explaining to the student what we could have done different, what we will do different next time, and also listening to their ideas, their input, both the student and the paying customer are our clients. And we're looking for satisfaction for both.
Thank you, Chef.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You've done a great job.
Fabulous. You know, it came out great, exactly as we thought it would be.
Oh, I know they are.
Hey, Tom, can I talk to you while you're cleaning?
Sure.
So, you ready to do this again tomorrow?
You bet. I'm ready to go again. This is something that's really enjoyable to me.
It's huge, though, to the bride
exactly.
And the groom. It's mm-hmm. their big event. Does that put extra pressure on you?
What I like to think of is when you have an event like this, if you remain unnoticed, it's great. I don't think there's any added pressure, because every event that you do is special to somebody.
Students Chris Thee and Tom Sweet, Chef Instructor Sue Dabowski of the New England Culinary Institute, and the happy newlyweds, Tempe Evans and Jeremy Wright. Stay with us. There's more. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Colby English professor James Boylan was a successful teacher and author with a wife and two children he adored. The one problem, Boylan felt that he was actually a she. And so, with the love of his family, and despite the acknowledged struggles of his wife, Grace, who lost so much while he gained so much, James Boylan became Jenny Finney Boylan. That journey is chronicled in Jenny's book, titled She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders, which is now out in paperback. So we thought we'd reprise a visit that Jenny Finney Boylan made to our studios last winter. We talked about her book and about becoming a woman. I began by remarking on what a beautiful woman she was.
Oh, get out of here.
Okay.
Look who's talking. It's radio, so they have to take your word
right.
for that.
Yeah, right. They have to believe me.
Thank you.
But the woman who was always inside you, I was astonished to read, even when you were 3 years old.
Yeah, and in fact, that's not atypical for transgendered people, that you have a sense of something being wrong. Just about your earliest memory.
In your case, it was you sitting there watching your mother iron.
Yeah, she was ironing shirts, and she said, "Someday you'll wear shirts just like your father's." And I thought, well, why?
Because you thought, I'll wear shirts like my mom.
That's right.
At three. And then as you grew up, it was something that you had an inner dialogue with yourself about these ideas. Oh, stop it. But there's a point where you share in the book where you actually used to go play a game in the woods called Girl Planet, which you are an astronaut who crashes in a world where you can become a girl. Would you mind reading for us? It's in the segment of the book early on, right after you've described this playing in the woods and people coming to say, we're looking for James Finney Boylan, the novelist. We found his rocket all smashed up in the woods. And you reply, oh, I'm sorry, he's gone now.
I did not know the word transsexual back then, and the word transgendered had not yet been invented. I'd heard the word transvestite, of course, but it didn't seem to apply to me. It sounded kind of creepy, like some kind of centipede or grub. In my mind, I sometimes confused it with the words that described cave formations. What was it again? Transvestites grew down from the top of the cave. Transvestmites grow up from the bottom. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit for the sake of time.
Mm-hmm.
Gender is many things, but one thing it is certainly not is a hobby. Being female is not something you do because it's clever or postmodern or because you're a deluded, deranged narcissist. In the end, what it is more than anything else is a fact. It's the dilemma of the transsexual, though, that it is a fact that cannot possibly be understood without imagination.
One of the people who had some trouble with that is your dear friend, it sounds like your best friend, Richard Russo, the author. You were both teachers at Colby, and he's, of course, I think of him as the tough guy, author of books like Nobody's Fool.
Right.
And he just really wrestles with the idea that this wasn't a choice that you made, like you just decided to do this.
I included the story of my friendship with Rick Russo in the book because I wanted for there to be a dissenting voice. I wanted to give the reader, who I most readers, I would presume, know very little about this topic, someone to speak for them and to give voice to all the reservations and confusions that people have. I didn't want to write a book that was self-congratulatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so in showing the ways in which Rick did come around in the end, I'm hoping that that can stand in for the ways that readers can come around too, because mm-hmm. ultimately this book is not about how to have a sex change. It's about the question that everybody asks, which is, how do I live an authentic life? How do I learn to find the courage to become myself?
And along the way, you take readers through the many tough steps of being authentic. And one of them was sitting down at the kitchen table one night and saying to your then-wife, Grace, I got to tell you something.
That's
you
right.
married her because you thought that love would make you change.
Yeah, I think that is something that is not the particular delusion of the transsexual. I think that's everyone. We all look to the people that we love to change us, to bring us out of ourselves. And when I fell in love with Grace, I really felt, wow, I'm cured. This thing that has always burdened me is gone. And yet, in the end, nothing is enough to cure you of something that is essentially a genetic condition. It's not about how much you are loved. It's not about how much you pray. And ultimately, is something that you simply have to accept.
How do you handle? I mean, you have two children who, by the way, I mean, there's a lot of hilarity in the book for something that's such an overwhelming topic. And, you know, the first time your children see you in a dress, they're sort of like, oh, yeah. What are your children
calling you now? My children, in fact, were quite sanguine about the business because they were able to understand a basic fact that in some ways eluded many adults, that the person who had been their father was not going away, that their parent loved them. This was not something that they had caused. Mm. My children, in fact, were the ones who came up with a new name for me. My older son, Luke, one day said, "We can't call you Daddy if you're a girl. That's just too weird." And I said, "Well, what do you want to call me?" And he said, "Well, how about Maddie? Because that's like half mommy and half daddy. And also, I know someone named Maddie at school." And I said, "Okay, Maddie's a good name."
What do you call Grace?
We call her Mommy.
And what do you, how do you define your relationship now?
Well, our relationship is still in flux. We are people who share a family, who share a friendship, and we are people who love each other.
Yeah. How lucky for us, the reader, that you telling us this story are also a terrific writer. It just so happens. And so the stories are told in sort of an essay form, how you encounter former students. And I'm thinking of other moments where you can see a world that we will not see. For instance, you have gone into both men's rooms and bathrooms as each gender.
That's right. I mean, in a way, I think I'm very grateful that that I was born transgendered, that there, I mean, it was always a curse to me, but there is a way in which I see it as a great gift because I have gotten to see two sides of the world, and most people only get to see one.
Can you tell us, I mean, the bathroom's one thing where you discovered that, well, that's why the girls are sometimes in there so long. They're taking a break. They're sitting on a chair and getting away from the guys.
We're taking a few, having a few short moments away from you, darling.
I also loved how you described that as a male professor, it irritated you so when young women ended every sentence with a question mark, even when you asked them their name.
When I asked them, it was worse to ask their names. "Hello, my name's Jenny. Hello, my name's Robin." And just, I remember when I was a guy, I would tell my students, "Do not say your name like it's a question. Your identity is not a question." Well, I found shortly after transition, I found that inflection sneaking into my own voice.
And oddly enough, you are finally who you've always known who you are, and you say your name with a question mark at the end.
Well,
because it's a woman's inflection.
I do if I don't think about it. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But it is true. I do know who I am. And I feel so grateful now. I feel as if I had been in prison for 40 years for something that I didn't do. And then at the last minute, I got pardoned by the governor. And so each day I walk around looking at the world, thinking, "Wow, I'm free."
Jennifer Finney Boylan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Her book is called She's Not There. And by the way, the title? Is it the song?
It's three things. It's the song of the zombies, which kind of haunts me throughout the book. It's also all those years, the first half of my life, when people would see a man, even though I was female in spirit and I was not there. And towards the end of the book, it refers to the fact that what's lost is a marriage and a wife. So in the end, she who is not there is a wife. That's the loss, and that was the price that was paid.
The book is called She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders by Jenny Finney Boylan. It's now out in paperback. For more information and photographs, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had to end the car. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our newscast producer is Jeremy Hobson. Our web producer is Zach Christo. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had turned the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.